But I don't know what to do with those tossed salad and scrambled eggs.
Doom, doom, doom.
They're calling again.
Good night, RSP. We love you.
Like that.
Was Fraser.
It was.
I got one of your references.
I started too low. It went all croaky.
Yeah.
Fantastic. We are the Religious Studies Project. Welcome, listeners. He is...
David Robertson, and he is...
Chris Carter.
And we're in... It's a horribly rainy afternoon here in Edinburgh, so we have come for a nice change to Frankenstein's, the scariest but also weirdly family-friendly pub, which used to be an old church and now is a sort of Hammer horror theme with Frankenstein playing on this big screens. And
yeah, if we're in here, if we're in here at night, there would be much more in the way of the spooky noises, and at various times they lower Frankenstein's monster down from the ceiling. And
I think, to be honest, though, the scariest thing in here at night would be the really, really drunk rugby students.
All those rugby students, yeah.
Rugby playing students.
This week we've got some book reviews for you, listeners.
So I think we need to just hand over to Jonathan Tuckett, our own Jonathan Tuckett, who's going to... He's going to introduce you to what is going to be a new regular format.
We do promise that for the next regular format version of this, the sound quality might be slightly better. I mean, we were trying some new things. So bear with it for this time. It's not, you can listen, and it's a great podcast. But next time we do one, we'll make sure it's tip-top quality for you. Take it away.
Hello, and welcome to the Religious Studies Project for what will hopefully be the first of many book review sessions. We've already tried it once before. We quite enjoyed the experience, and we hope that you enjoyed it too. So we're going to subject it to you on a more regular basis. So the format is going to be quite simple. I have with me today three aspiring young academics who have all read books by already established academics, and they're going to share their thoughts on them. So they'll share about 5 minutes each on the book, and then we'll probably spend about another 20 minutes, half an hour, just having a general conversation about what was going on. Okay, so today I have with me, I have the lovely Beth Singler from Cambridge University. Say hello, Beth.
Hello.
Hello. I also have Chris Duncan from Edinburgh University.
Hello.
And Liam Templeton Sutherland from Edinburgh University also.
Hello.
Right, okay, so without further ado, I feel we should begin with ladies first. So, Beth has been... Something wrong with that, Beth?
No, absolutely fine. Let's stick to the established hierarchies of ladies first.
Yeah, good. Okay, so Beth has been reading Philosophical Explorations of New and Alternative Religious Movements, edited by Morgan Luck. So, Beth, what did you think of the book?
Right, I think I probably should start with a description of me, because I'm more important than the book, obviously. But to put cards on the table, I'm a social anthropologist of religion, specifically, new religious movements. So this book's quite a good choice for me, anyways. But reading it, I wasn't entirely sure who it was aimed at, and I think the editor recognises this in his comment on page 6. About whether this is a book for philosophers of religion or sociologists of religion, and hoping that by getting philosophers of religion involved with new religious movements, he'll generate some sort of interest in the cross-fertilization of ideas. But reading it, I'm a little stumped, really, because philosophy of religion's not my passion. So I was left a little cold, although there is a lot of worth in the book, lots of things that are valuable, but logical arguments about premises held by new religious movements is a slightly different approach, I suppose, than what I'm used to. What else would I say about I suppose it sort of came down to the question of so what, really, if you can prove that premise A follows onwards to premise B in Scientology, that doesn't really actually explain very much about what's going on. The internal logic of some of the ideas of Scientology is very interesting. and there's other groups covered, Raelianism, the Word of Faith movement, the Arica, there's various different groups, and lots of interesting sort of information, but sort of the main emphasis on the logical arguments from premise to premise is not something I'm particularly familiar with or that comfortable with. I don't know, I sort of felt that the aims of the book weren't cogent, or at least clearly understandable, I suppose. Some of the chapters were particularly interesting. I found the digital theology section particularly clear. It's an area that I'm starting to look at around transhumanism as well. But whether we would describe this as a religious movement or not, I'm not entirely swayed by the argument on that. Just because debates about immortality are involved, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a religious coalition. In fact, most transhumanists would be quite upset by that description, although I suppose you could grab them as a sort of form of material pantheism. And citing Dawkins' attitude about the great computer is quite interesting, because he particularly would not be keen on being described as a member of any kind of religious group. The chapter on the Word of Faith movement was particularly relevant for my work as well, which I was quite interested in, this idea of evolutionary models moving us up to the state where we would be gods in some way, even if through a Christian model. But as a whole, as a project, I'm not entirely convinced by this book, and I'm interested to see how it's received, whether it be received particularly differently by sociologists of religion, by philosophers of religion. I described it to a couple of philosophers of religion that I knew, and they were slightly dismissive, I suppose, that they didn't see that this was a worthwhile project. But I suppose it opens up the debate, at least, as a starting point. And then you can see where it might go. But I'm not sure entirely the decision for which groups would be involved as well. There was no sort of overarching agreement of which new religious movements classified as new religious movements or not. So that was something else I considered when I read this. So there's a few of my initial thoughts. I suppose there's a few things we could open up for discussion there.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Beth. I'm just going to turn over to Liam, because Chris has wandered away very briefly for a second. So Liam has been reading Food, Sex and Strangers, Understanding Religion as Everyday Life by Graham Harvey. So, Liam, if you'd care to share your preliminary thoughts on Graham.
Okay. In this book, Graham Harvey is attempting to approach the study of religion from elsewhere, as he describes it. That is, outside the conventional top-down, belief-centric approach derived from European Protestantism. To do this, he explores religion through a variety of cases, Maori, Ojibwa, Yoruba, Jewish, and neo-pagan, and attempting to re-examine Christianity in light of these, as it is actually lived out by its practitioners. This is refreshing in a theoretical text which should draw in students and demonstrate how theoretical issues relate to people on the ground. He considers how religion could be shown to some, for example, he asks the interesting question, how would you show religion to some visiting space aliens? As even human beings can't see belief in the transcendent, but can experience the bells and smells of ritual, visit religious buildings, and participate in practices such as meditation. The driving concern of the book is how religions are best observed and described, and Harvey urges scholars to focus on the vastly divergent doings and sayings of religious practitioners, rather than putting people into neat boxes according to lists of tenets. The other primary concern is representation. Harvey contends that traditions should not be represented in terms alien to them. Not so much that foreign terms such as religion should not be used, but rather they should not be presented as mirror images of Protestantism, e.g. belief in the transcendent, any more than we would describe Protestantism in terms of bold sacrifice. These basic contentions are ones that few scholars of religion could broadly disagree with, but reveal some underlying problems with his argument. Harvey contends that religion has been misdefined because it is a thing which has been inaccurately described, not a comparative device. He's strident about the inappropriate use of belief because of its specific cultural origins, but casually dismisses similar objections to the use of religion. He asks the interesting question, what if religion was approached from a Jewish or a Maori angle based on, say, observance or taboo? This would allow scholars to pick up on features which have been ignored or downplayed in, for example, Protestantism, such as the importance of church bake sales or the maintenance of church grounds. He never considers, though, that studies of belief may do exactly the same thing. He assumes that, for example, makes many assumptions, for example, that orthopraxy entails a lack of belief, that belief was perfectly represented as a concept by the likes of William James and Rudolf Otto as an inner philosophical state, rather than a part of everyday life. The most infuriating aspect of this book is its moralising, its inclusion of a kind of system of deep green ethics, which simply do not sit well with his theoretical aims. He admits that religion is not necessarily nice, but suggests at various points that real religion is about living with a multi-species community, a similar cross-cultural assumption as the ones he's criticising. And he assumes that it involves things like recognising the pervasiveness of personhood, which contradicts his own emphasis on the highly specific and taught nature of religious traditions. For example, in Ojibwa thought, Ojibwa animism, not all rocks are persons, but some are. This is contrasted, all of this real religion is contrasted with a shadowy construction of modernism, which is not even clear enough to be a straw man. Rather, it is a balloon inflated or deflated to suit Harvey's whims. The reader is simply forced to take Harvey's word for it that modernists all believe that the world can be directly observed, that nature and culture are separate, or that individuals are atomized from each other and society. That is, despite the fact that these very premises were overturned by natural and social sciences inspired by the ideas of truth and progress, as indeed was greater appreciation of the importance of the environment. One of the strengths of the book, however, is its emphasis on religions as specific systems of taboo, which divide and negotiate between categories of sacred and profane, insider and outsider, proper and improper, male and female, stranger and kin or guest, as well as things which are safe or good to eat from those which are unclean. It offers us a chance to reflect on Harvey's lament that scholars of religion are somehow afraid to approach their topic in the same way a culinary course would approach their topic. The study of religion, I contend, has its own system of taboos, which divide appropriate from inappropriate and allow us to do our work, protecting both scholars and the people under study through a system of rules. If religious studies must be compared to a cookery course, as Harvey insists, then it would be one that involves a mixed group of omnivores, vegans, Atkins and gluten-free dieters, and our taboos help us to negotiate this.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Liam, as forward as ever. That's really great. Thanks a lot. Okay, so I'm going to turn over to Chris now. Chris has been reading The Invention of God in Indigenous Societies by James Cox. So, Chris, what did you think?
Well, let me first start off by saying, as a grad student who was reviewing the most recent book written by my very own Professor Emeritus. Let me first say, the book was amazing. I thought it was just outstanding in every shape, way, and form, and couldn't have been formulated nor written in a more perfect sense. The point of the book, it's entitled The Invention of God in Indigenous Societies, and that essentially tells you everything you need to know. Jim essentially sits down, looks at various indigenous societies in New Zealand, Australia, Zimbabwe, and Alaska. And what he's trying to point out, he starts off by going through very much a theoretical foundation, addressing common tropes of invention of traditions, post-colonialism, modernization, cultural interaction, etc. What he's trying to say is rather than simply recycle these ideas of the invention of traditions, he utilizes a new concept that he calls cultural hybridity. He actually takes it from a Russian linguist, I believe, named Bakhtin. What he is attempting to tell everybody is, rather than simply fall back on our tropes of inventedness of traditions, what we should really be looking at is the motives and motivations behind the invention of the tradition. So he identifies what he calls organic and intentional hybridity. That would be an example of organic hybridity would be an invasion by Christian European missionaries, where the local tradition simply absorbed the Christian ideas, relabeled them to fit into their own worldview, and simply move on from there. They kind of just bang on. An example of intentional hybridity would be really the mirror opposite, the forcing upon a local indigenous society of the beliefs of the Christian colonizers. The point being, for Cox, that not only do we need to look at, like I said, the interwoven nature of colonial sociological gettings on, we really need to be looking at the motives and motivations behind the people on the ground. And he really focuses a lot, as he's wont to do, on the motives and motivations of the locals. He does bring into his discussion various European actors, as everything is set within a colonial setting. However, he specifically looks at how the local indigenous societies reacted to and assimilated within the Christian colonial experience. That's good enough for now.
Okay, that's a great introductory comment. The reason I picked the books that you guys have all read is because there was a certain emphasis behind all three texts of this idea that we've gone about our approach to the topic wrong, and we kind of need to rethink how we go about it. So the question I want to put to all three of you with your respective books is, in these books, do you think they've done enough for you as the reader to rethink about how you are doing what you are already doing?
No, not really. No. Like I said, I think it's a worthwhile attempt at taking these subjects and these groups seriously, as taking new religious movements seriously, philosophical perspective, but it really makes no difference whether these premises follow logically on from each other. It's much more important whether they have some sort of effective appeal to people and why they get involved and what they do when they are involved. And the chapter that gets to dealing with that is non-cognitive reasons for conversion, and that's the most sociological chapter in the book, and that's the one I found most appealing. So I'm obviously a social anthropologist at heart, not a philosopher of religion, but I suppose taking these subjects seriously is still close to my heart as well. But no, the bottom line is no, I haven't changed my methodology upon reading this book.
Okay, and Leo and Chris, what do you think?
Well, I suppose I can give the ultimate ridiculous academic answer, yes and no. With more emphasis on the no, because I feel that it is quite a frustrating book, because he does start off quite promising. Like, he will discuss, in some ways it would be a good text for undergraduate teaching or for introducing people to theory, just because he does start to reflect on where we're approaching the concept of religion, or rather the study of religion, from, what kind of cultural biases are loaded in there, and what we could possibly do to study it from elsewhere, which is a perfectly valid aim. He does provide quite a few interesting examples to that effect about trying to understand the mindset of the people that are under study. Like, for example, he talks about the Kachina masks, which are used by the Hopi people in southwest of the United States. And, like, for example, in their mindset, if you go through the motions of making a Kachina mask or a koko, it becomes a Kachina mask if you've done the rites correctly. It's not about whether you believe in it or not. If you've done the rites correctly, it's a Kachina mask and is inhabited by a Kachina spirit. And that's all very interesting. But unfortunately, he just gets lost in his own normative agenda and then starts committing the exact same things he's criticising, albeit from his own angle, about how all religion has this real underlying sort of animist framework that he considers to be right, basically. That's my assumption. That's what I have to read into it.
And yourself, Chris? I personally enjoyed the book immensely. Not to rub salt into the wound of my co-panelists. My personal specialization is in Hinduism, the South Asian traditions, and particularly Hindus in diaspora, particularly in Europe and Britain. So I'm very much in tune with this postmodern academic idea of stressing the agency of the colonized, trying to, ironically, rewrite our own academic history for over the past two centuries, where everything has been written from an Anglo-European perspective. And what Cox really tries to do throughout the book, and I was just reading it to make sure that if I quote him, I'm accurate, but he really stresses towards the end, he's not making any normative statements. He acknowledges and says quite clearly, yes, all traditions are invented. But that's too Levi-Straussian. It doesn't need to be a binary of invented or non-invented. What he's trying to show is there is an aspect of inventedness to ostensibly every religious tradition and every society, regardless of whether you're looking religious or you know, economic or political, what have you. And it's more about how do we unpack the different layers. Throughout the book, what he's actually using as his case studies is the invention of the Christian God in various indigenous traditions. Was the Christian God a universal that existed in these various indigenous societies? Was it an import that was brought along with the missionaries and the colonizers? What was it? And essentially what he says is it's both. It's different things in different situations. So for academics, rather than looking at and continuing banging on about the inventedness of a particular society, it doesn't really help us at all. What we should then do is move to the second order argument of what type of inventedness. And this is where his idea of cultural hybridity comes in. I did have a bit of a problem with his designations of organic and intentional hybridity. For me, organic hybridity implies just that, organic. There was no intentionality behind it. So I would prefer, perhaps, if he said passive and active hybridity, that might be kind of give you the right quality. So if it's passive hybridity, then missionaries brought in their ideas, they have this idea of a Christian God, the locals simply took it and said, oh yeah, that sounds just like Aya. We're cool, move on. That's not organic hybrid. There's still intentionality. There's still two separate agencies there. There's nothing really organic about it. Passive, perhaps, yes. Organic, no. But that's really my only area of infant. Other than that, he sets off with a methodological discussion, laying everything out for the reader in the very beginning. He goes through four different case studies, and then ends on a theoretical note where he's actually pushing his argument. So it's laid out well, it's clear, it's well posted very nicely, and it was a great read for someone like me who doesn't deal with indigenous societies all that much.
This next question is a little bit more direct to Liam and Chris, just because, Beth, in your book, you have philosophical in the title, which kind of immediately sets the tone of this is the sort of book that you're going to be reading, although I'll turn the question back on to you in a second. But the question I want to ask Chris and Liam is, would you say that the books that you have read are more philosophical or are they more empirical books?
I'll start off on that one. Because Cox says at least 100 times, I could be exaggerating slightly, but we'll say plus or minus 5, that he is sticking explicitly with an empirical methodology. And furthermore, that is the only substantive, accurate way of doing an academic study of religion, particularly in an indigenous society. He literally says empirical at least 100 times. In that, he's making no value judgments. He's simply taking what people say, and based on his own field work in Alaska as well, looking at the discourse and making an observation from there. There is no qualitative judgments involved.
Well, actually, this is what I think is one of the great strengths of the book, is the fact that it is, I suppose it's more of a theoretical text. I wouldn't say philosophical, but I suppose that's sort of our version of philosophy to some extent. Jonathan might disagree, actually, but anyway, but it does have its finger in quite a lot of empirical pies, which I like. I mean, they're not in-depth ethnographies or anything like that, but he actually has, to some extent, participated and done a little bit of research in all these communities. So he has these personal experiences to draw on, and they're backed up with quite good empirical data drawn from other scholars, and they do give it, his theoretical discussion, a location or set of locations, and I think that's a great thing. I think that's what more theoretical texts should be doing, ideally. However, just to go back on what Chris was saying, and you'll have picked this up from what I've been saying previously anyway, is yes, he does have a very clear normative, or rather, he has a normative agenda, but it's not, it's so extra to what he's saying. It's not even, I mean, there's normative and there's normative. I mean, he just makes a theoretical discussion about his interests in environmentalism and so on that has so little to do with his theoretical discussion. It's not even just, you know, emerging from the material and then he makes a value judgment. He should have written two different books, to be quite frank.
Okay. Can I just
quickly jump in with a point there?
Yeah.
So, I think although explicitly this book doesn't make any value judgments, there's an implicit value judgment in the argument that an argument in a new religious movement is logical or not. And that's the sort of the gap in the book where you get to the summation of all the logical, philosophical arguments and underlying the suggestion that yes, this is correct or no, this is not correct is a value judgment, which I'm not comfortable with.
Interesting. I'm going to have to ask you two questions now. Is there an extended discussion of what they mean by logical in the book or not?
It's the classical mode of logic in philosophy. If, like I say, if premise A, then premise B, then premise C, and following that, actually, it is actually more geared to someone who's sized a little bit more in following those logical arguments than a general audience as well, or general academic audience. So yes, they are trying to debate sort of the Mormon concept of God or the Raelian concept of God. Are these premises logical? Do they follow on from each other? If they do, then tick. If they don't, then cross. But there's no, like I say, there's no explicit value judgment in that, but in finding that tick or that cross, I think there is an implicit value judgment that isn't going to sit well with social anthropologists of new religious movements.
Okay, that's interesting.
Like me.
I want to steal a comment from Liam, because Liam said one of the strengths of Graham's book is the idea that his theory is localized in various empirical cases. Do you think your book lacks that localization? Do you think there needs to be more? Is there not enough empirical study going on to ground philosophical concepts?
I assume most of these premises are texts, because if you actually went and spoke to the average Raelian or 6, 7, 8 average Raelians, they may not have picked up these premises as perfectly and as clearly as the book presents them. So I think it's textual based, which is not anything to do with the lived experience of a new religious movement for the majority of believers. They don't always go back and immediately refer to the text to get their premises right or correct as according to the text. So yeah, like I said, the whole book left me cold because there isn't that interacting with membership. But then it's not meant to be that kind of book.
Okay, I'm going to feed on this. Like, it's clearly not meant to be that kind of book, but the very title of, like, talking about new and alternative religious movements suggests that it should be that kind of book. So, if you compare what Chris is saying, which Chris has
given high praise to Cox's book, which presumably it does have a theoretical working in it, and there are theoretical discussions within the context of the book, but it's framed within the empirical discussion. So is the problem, because I'm curious about, because yours is an edited volume, Beth, how much attention did you actually pay to who these authors were and where they'd actually been coming from? I mean, were these authors primarily philosophers writing about religion, or were these people actually working in religious studies type departments who decided, let's have a go at philosophy?
To be honest, I hadn't looked. I mean, I recognised, of course, George Crusaders, who writes an excellent overview of the term New Religious Movement and where it comes from, and he's an expert in that, and I know him quite well. But the other authors that I'm looking now are mostly philosophers, theologians. So this is outside their comfort zone, but it's still, they're approaching it from the philosophical perspective. So we don't have any social anthropologists. Probably would not actually consider this as a starting perspective. So it's very much a philosophical book, a book analysing the philosophy of new religious movements.
Okay.
Which at least gives them some sort of credibility.
Okay, this question is going to be less directed at Chris because he liked the book so much, but in the case of Liam and Beth, what would you like to see in these books that would help make it more relevant or more useful for you?
Does Liam want to go first? Because I've just been talking.
Okay. Well, I would like entire chapters of this book to disappear and reappear in some other form, basically, to stop distracting from his actual theoretical aims, so that we actually could use this as quite a good introductory text to theory. I mean, I would also, if he is going to start discussing modernism and things like that, I mean, he needs to outline what he means by that and, you know, delve a little bit more into the history and, you know, treat this vague category of various intellectual traditions with the same sort of, at least implicit respect, as he would want religious traditions to be treated. You know, try to at least understand what they meant and how all these different people he's classified under modernism differ from each other, you know? So that's, I suppose, primarily it. I would like to see I feel like one of the few people in religious studies who thinks the term belief is actually quite a useful analytical term, but he's certainly in good company in not wanting to use it, and it's perfectly defensible. I would like to see more engagement with scholars who actually do use it in a different sense, rather than just sort of dismissing them and relying on William James, who hasn't been current for about 100 years. Was there a last point?
I'm going to cut in there. Sorry, I know, Beth, I did ask you a question. I will come back to it, but Liam's given me two questions that I want to direct to both you and Chris, because if Liam's raised this issue of both modernism and belief. Modernism in the sense that modernism is a clearly undefined concept. So my first question to both of you is, do either of your texts deal with the question of modernism, and do you think they've dealt with it in a satisfactory manner?
Since Liam's just been talking, I'll jump in there first then. He does deal with modernism to an extent in the opening theoretical chapter. He kind of bookends his case studies with theoretical discussions. One, giving the introductory theoretical chapter is actually more of a contextualizing the situation. And he does compare and contrast the evolutionist and the modernist philosophical places from which early 20th century, late 19th century academics did study indigenous societies.
And what about you, Beth?
Oh, sorry, I was waiting on the chance to answer the previous question.
Oh, sorry. which question would you rather answer first? Lady's choice.
Now I've forgotten the previous question.
Okay, we'll go with modernism.
What would I like the book to be doing, I think?
Yeah,
what would you do differently?
And what would make this book better? in some ways. This book is not really one or another thing. It's not really a book for people who study new religious movements and social anthropology, and it's not really a book for philosophers of religion, because I started thinking more about philosophy of religion as I read it and what the purpose, as I see it, because I, looking at it as an outsider, what the purpose of the philosophy of religion is. And I think to a certain extent it's conversion. It's proving truth, which is a term I don't really use ever. It's proving truth to a logical degree and saying, well, this is the truth, so why aren't you following the truth to a certain extent? So this book is problematic to me because none of the people involved in it are trying to prove the truth of a new religious movement that they actually adhere to. So there's this just disjoint. And I think this book is a nice sort of thought project, but perhaps one that we could leave on a shelf somewhere. And maybe I'll return to it in 10 years and be converted to the idea of philosophy of religion. But.
And the question of modernism, because particularly with my own background in philosophy and knowledge of philosophy of religion, I know modernism isn't normally a topic that actually gets addressed. So I'm curious to know if it gets addressed in this book.
I don't recall coming across it, really. I suppose everyone would flag up transhumanism as an aspect of modernity. But I think it's long-term questions and ideas and theories attached to some cybernetic bells and whistles, really. Not to be dismissive of the transhumanists, who I will be doing some work on, but yes, I don't think there's much in this book that relates directly to ideas of modernity.
Okay, interesting. And also the other concept that Liam mentioned, belief. Liam is advocating that we are allowed to talk to belief, whereas certain scholars wouldn't talk about belief. I mean, what are your two respective thoughts on that question? And also, do you think the books themselves address that topic at all, either?
Who wants to go first?
Go ahead.
Okay. No, belief doesn't really pop up in this. There's statements and premises and logical constructions of what follows what, and those statements, of course, are attached to beliefs, particular groups, but the writers writing about them are not discussing them in terms of belief. They're discussing them in terms of statements.
Belief does come into this book. I mean, with the title of The Invention of God. That's kind of quite clear. In his case study analyses, what he tries to do is take the idea of a creator God, again, something, some kind of equivalent to the Christian God, and he works backwards. He almost reverse engineers the last two centuries of academic work and says, well, this is what we currently think. This is what has been said about, again, Maori or Io or some kind of indigenous deity. Where did these come from? Who gave us this information? Were the informants converted into the actual church before they became informants, as in the case, and I believe, Zimbabwe or Australia? Was this simply, like I referenced earlier, the indigenous receiving society finding correlations between their existing deities and the ideas of the missionaries? So belief does come into play. I don't personally have a problem with using that word as a valid analytical tool, concept at the very minimum. He's looking more at discourse. He's analyzing more of discourse rather than the ontological factuality of a deity or not.
Okay, we are kind of starting to run out of time, so I'll just leave it open again for anybody's final comments on their respective books, because the general impression that I'm getting right now is that Chris liked his book, Beth and Liam did not like their books.
It's not so much about like or dislike as whether I see this as a useful book, and for my perspective, my methodology, it's not. Although there's some interesting nuggets of information in there that I didn't know.
Okay, I'm just going to briefly jump on that because we are aware that Stephen Sutcliffe has recently published an edited volume. So I'm going to quickly address this question directly to you so that to ping forward to future book reviews and whether you'd be interested in reviewing on Stephen Sutcliffe's edited volume on New Religious Movements with an aim of comparing it to this book to see which of the two is more useful for you.
Absolutely. I am actually reviewing it for someone else, so that's handy when it eventually turns up.
Academic honesty, Beth. Academic honesty.
Yes, I can certainly do that. Okay. When it turns up, I'm waiting still.
Great, there we go. So listeners will be pleased to know that we've already bagged another review. But as for my other two reviewers, any final comments on your books?
Not that I can think of.
I probably should make one brief statement about the audience and utility of the book. It is very much an RS-style book. You can tell just by the things that he says, he's acknowledging and engaging with current discussions in religious studies in particular. And it's a very good introductory text, but probably more along the lines of third, fourth year undergrads, because one does already need to be aware of debates and arguments and disagreements in the academic community along the lines of ideas like cultural interaction and inventiveness of traditions. So one definitely needs to be aware of that already. But again, for something that's only tangentially related to my topic of research, I thought it was very eye-opening and really gave me an example of a good way to attack a particular idea while remaining in that famous epoche stage. The word I hate.
I am making no comment.
He definitely does toe the line of, I'm not saying left nor right, I'm simply telling you that left and right existed in their particular states.
I suppose I should really say that this book, in a lot of ways, would be very useful. I think selected passages from it would be perfect for undergraduate teaching and actually getting them to think about the categories they're using, about relations of power between different traditions and societies. It just needs to lose all of this normative stuff and really shore up its arguments, have a much clearer conception of what he's trying to argue, and also just a little bit more kindness to his intellectual opponents, you know, fairness to the contrary position. And not, I think he's in perfectly good company not using the concept of belief. It's a perfectly defensible position. However, it's just because not everyone is caught in a William James mindset who actually does want to use the concept, you know. I think that's really all I need to say.
Okay, and on that final definitive point from Liam, we will end our book review session here. So it only remains for me to thank Chris, Beth, and Liam for being good sports and reading books. Two out of three weren't exactly the best of things in the world, but we'll skip past that aspect. And it also remains to me to thank you, the listener, for listening. This has been the Religious Studies Project. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and also my thanks to the BSR. If you have any recommendations for books, because there will be more book review sessions coming forward, by all means contact us on Facebook and Twitter. We're always keen to hear any recommendations you have. And on behalf of myself and my reviewers, all that remains to be said is
thanks for listening.
Oh, way to go, Matt. That was good.
Well, hopefully we won't lose our BASR sponsorship after Liam's rant there.
No, that is just as evidence of not only how cool the BASR are, but that we are impartial, you know? There's a fair bit of criticism of Graham's book in there, but that's okay. We're objective. And also really interesting idea of having Beth come back on to compare that book with the Sutcliffe and Gilhus book, as a tag onto the end of the next reviews episode. That's so keeping that conversation going that we've got with that book and that field in general.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to being involved in another book review podcast after hearing that.
I think he doesn't want us to be.
Does the monastery?
No, I don't think so. I've a couple of times said, I'll do that, I'll do this one. Ah. And he keeps putting me down the list further and further. But now I've just said I'm doing one.
Good. Well, I mean, I've got 3 book reviews due with other journals, so sorry if you're listening. But after that point, then yeah, roll on book reviews.
Well, I got through the BASR, I got a big box of books to review, and there was 3 of the Inform series, and one of which I was so interested in, I read on the spot, and another one I'm in. So I thought, why don't we do an episode that we just review the Inform series? So we're going to get one more of those and do an episode that's just based on the Inform series, which I think would be quite an interesting format.
Fantastic. Talking of episodes.
Yeah. Well, you'll be asking about next week's, won't you?
Yeah, next week it's another one with the maestro that is Tommy Coleman.
Boom! Tommy Coleman. And this time he's speaking to Kevin Ladd about the psychology of prayer.
Should be pretty interesting.
Should be interesting.
Yeah.
Sometimes Tommy's titles, you're a bit like, not sure about that, but he always delivers. He always does.
He's on the level. And by the time that you hear that next week, I will have, of course, met the man in the flesh.
Yeah.
Oh, it's going to be so cool. It's going to be a letdown, isn't it?
Yeah.
We, as we've said, we're brought to you by the BASR. The sort of gossip's starting to hot up now about their conference that's coming up in Milton Keynes.
Hey, let's talk a little bit more about that next week. This has been quite a long episode. Let's talk about the conference, because we've got some ideas there and there's stuff happening.
All right. Amazon, Facebook, iTunes, Google+, Twitter. Find us there. For now, folks.
Thanks for listening.